You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 257, Exodus 2, 1-10. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, Super Bowl weekend. How are you?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm disappointed. You know, I wanted New Orleans and Kansas City, and so look what I got. You know, I got the two other teams, you know.
I know.
I'll probably watch a little of it, you know, just to say I did it, and then think about the fact that we've got, what, 20 days or so, or less, before pitchers and catchers have to report.
Oh my gosh, I just checked out.
I like the dead zone because I don't like hockey. I don't like basketball. So it's like I'm just like in limbo, you know.
We got March Madness coming up. Oh, I love March Madness. Great.
I used to watch it, but you know, I don't know. I just sort of dropped off the radar. But
I love it. Well, do you have any predictions for the Super Bowl?
I think if the Rams defensive line can control the line of scrimmage, the Rams will win. That's about as far as I can go. It all depends on that. Brady has time. He's going to just be Brady. If he doesn't, then it'll be a different story.
I'll ride him and Belichick to the end. So there you go.
Now, Belichick's entertaining. He's like this mad genius. So, you know, it'll be interesting. So I'll watch it, at least a little of it. I don't know if I'll watch the whole thing, but I'm still disappointed. I'm still getting over. You know, I wanted a Super Bowl that was going to be like 50-45, you know, something crazy like that. Yeah. But
We may get it. Just depends on the Rams defense. Well, for those people who don't watch American football or the Super Bowl, I don't know why you would not want to do that. But fortunately, you have Exodus 2 coming your way right now.
There you go. This might, in fact, be more entertaining, especially if the team that you want to win doesn't win. So. Yeah, I've gotten more than a few emails about the Exodus series. You know, it's just like, man, it's so detailed and it's like, you know, cool stuff. And I got to go listen to it two or three times. Well, good. You know, I kind of tried to warn you ahead of time. We're gonna be hitting the, you know, quagmires. We're gonna get deep into the woods here, into the weeds, into the papyrus. Okay, you can't really avoid it in this book. And today is more of the same. With Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. But before we begin, one of the emails I got, it prompted me to, I thought it'd be a good idea to spend a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes here, commenting on some previous content. I got a question or an email, a comment from Chris, who's an archaeologist and a specialist in historical geography of the Bible at Bar Ilan University in Israel. And he wrote me and he said, just basically, I'm not going to go through the whole email, but he said, I've heard Jim Hoffmeyer from Wheaton, who's an Egyptologist, and of course has the very useful book, Israel in Egypt, the evidence of for the authenticity of the Exodus tradition, which I have referenced in the earlier episodes a bit. Chris says, I've heard Hoffmeyer talk about the textual updating idea of Chuck Ayling. For those who have listened to the first two episodes on chapter one, you know what we're talking about here. And Hoffmeyer, he said, counters that it is problematic for Avaris to have been updated to Ramses or Ra'amses when Ramses was only a major Egyptian town until the 20th dynasty. A late updating during the presumed editorial activity for the Pentateuch, which is the exile or shortly thereafter, would be centuries after the 20th dynasty. And so Chris says it wouldn't mean anything to later Israelites who would not be aware of a city named Ramses or Ra'amses. In Psalm 78, again, we have a reference to Zoan, which is actually a later name of the same place, or at least the same region, that we're talking about here. So he says, in other words, if Ayling's editorial activity is coherent, again, a scribe would have updated the name from Avaris to Zoan, not Ra'amses. Now, a couple comments here. That of course is coherent, you know, as it's stated, but there are two possible responses to it. Again, just so that you get the idea that Chris is raising here, if it's true that the place, you know, we're talking about these two store cities in Exodus 1:11, Pithom and Ra'amses to be more precise. And we talked during our chronology episode that, you know, the early daters get, you know, address this or get around it. by proposing that Ramses as a name is an editorial updating, again, when the Pentateuch was edited and updated. And there are other examples of this. Bethel, Luz is a good example, very transparent in scripture. And so they postulate this kind of thing happened. And so Ramses in Exodus 1:11 does not force a late date for the Exodus, something in the 1200s. Of course, the early date is the one that takes 1 Kings 6:1 literally, and that's the mid-1400s BC. So the fact that Ramses is in there and his time period is in the 1200s BC, that doesn't force us to say the Exodus was dated to that time. Ramses could have just wound up in the text because of this editorial updating during the exile or shortly thereafter, the 500s, we'll call it, BC. And Chris's point is that, well, that wouldn't make sense because if they were updating the text then, they would have used Zoan instead of Ramses. So again, there are a couple possible responses to this. You know, and Redford's article that we talked about when we discussed Exodus 1:11 notes this on page 402. The presumed editor could still have an editor in the 500s BC still inserting or using Ramses deliberately to give the story an archaic flavor. Now, to some listening, that would just seem like fictionalizing something or you know, playing a little too fast and loose with the editorial idea that the writer knows that, well, the city's called Zoan now, but we're going to call it Ramses, you know, to sort of get back to the original antiquity, you know, of the Exodus event and preserve that then. Again, that might sound like fictionalizing. The problem with sort of looking at it that way, this possibility, is books like Job. I mean, Job has a mix, and everybody, you know, all scholars who study Job know this. It has a mix of late Hebrew features and early, not only a few early Hebrew features or earlier Hebrew features, but the book itself is set in a patriarchal setting. So you could have a writer writing late, again, 500s BC, and putting things into the story to, you know, give it an archaic flavor. Of course, the problem with that is that people would say, well, Job can get away with that because it's wisdom literature. Exodus is, again, is historical, and so that we feel less comfortable there. Again, I understand that, but go back to our very first episode when we jumped into the book of Exodus. We asked questions like, well, how much precision do we need to be precise or to call something history? I mean, ancient books, ancient writers do this sort of thing. And even though we wouldn't do it the way we write history now, they did do this sort of thing. So the fact that they do it doesn't rule out historicity. I mean, in Job's case, there really could have been a person named Job, you know, who suffered and so on and so forth. And then, you know, his reason for suffering gets, you know, theological dimensions because, you know, of how the book begins. And theologizing his suffering. So it doesn't rule out Job's historicity. And that's just the way the book is crafted. In other words, the ancient person wouldn't have read that and concluded just out of the gate, well, there was never really somebody named Job, and we know this is just sort of an allegory. A lot of people would have thought there was a person named Job, and then they're getting a behind-the-scenes look, you know, in the spiritual world about why this guy is suffering when he's righteous. So the fact that this can happen doesn't rule out historicity. So that's the first approach, you know, that a writer could still have used Ramses and, you know, to give it an archaic flavor. Second is the longer one. Redford, of course, again, we referenced his article on Exodus 1:11. Redford, you know, listeners should know by this point, doesn't buy Hofmeyr's argument that since Ramses was only a major town until the 20th dynasty, the editorial updating must have been at the time of Ramses or shortly thereafter, you know, like 12th, 11th century BC. Redford doesn't buy it because he questions whether the name itself refers to the town specifically, as opposed to merely associating the store cities with Ramses, the person. And Redford marshals evidence for the imprecision of equating the name with the actual city or residence. He actually, you know, says in a different article, this is actually Redford in Anchor Bible Dictionary, he says this: it's important since Zoan became the official pharaonic residence, replacing the old Ramesside capital, P. Ramesses. And then again, he's going to go on in what he writes to distinguish the sort of the place regionally and the person Ramses from the actual residence, you know, the town and the residence within the town. So Redford doesn't view all these things as sort of a whole. He divides up the parts, and then he asks the question, you know, does the name really, is it really about the city, the place? Again, that Hofmeyr would say, well, it is about the city, and it was only, you know, the royal residence there until the 20th dynasty. So Redford, sort of out of the gate, it just looks at it, approaches it from a different trajectory. He asks, again, Redford asks in his article on Exodus 111, is the name Raamses in Exodus 111 to be equated with Ramses II's capital? Again, the specific site. He doesn't think so. Again, we noted that in the earlier episode, and Redford goes on. Here's one of his arguments. Is it not strange that if the two Egyptian toponyms, place names, were borrowed around 1200 BC by the Hebrews, that the element per in per ra mes su, that's the Egyptian spelling for that one, and per atom for Pithom. He says, doesn't it seem strange that the two Egyptian toponyms were borrowed? If they were borrowed, the element per should be retained in per atom, which is Pithom, but suppressed or done away with in per ra mes su. You don't get Pith Ram Raamses, you just get Raamses. You don't get any of that first syllable is gone. So Redford thinks, again, that's just strange. Why keep it with one and not the other? And this is what prompts him to argue that the Hebrew spelling without that per element actually is the result of getting the place name or the name, you know, the name of the person, from Greek material, which is very late. Again, so this is the logic that Redford uses. Something I didn't get into in the last, you know, episode or the episode we did on chronology. Redford continues. He says this idea, the idea of very late updating, agrees, you know, with other things. Specifically, it agrees with the fact that from the Saite period, well on into Roman times, there was a flourishing city called Pithom in the northeastern delta. While there is no evidence that prior to the Saites, which are very late, there's no evidence prior to them that a city named Pithom ever existed in Egypt. Now, that creates a problem because when you read Exodus 1:11, we're talking about the store cities of Pithom and Ramses. So Redford's going to say, look, just the fact that historically we don't get a city known as Pithom until very late, he says that bolsters, you know, his argument about what to do with Ramses. Again, very late editorial kind of activity. So, you know, Redford is going to object, you know, to this, and you know, we really get down to the question of how do we get Pithom as a store city, and how can we reconcile that with all that we've said about Ramses? So I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but you know, for Chris, and this is kind of geeking out here a little bit. I wish that Hofmeyr had dealt, you know, with some of the contentions of Redford. He deals with some, but he leaves some out. Hofmeyr does cite the work of a couple other scholars who object to Redford's idea that Ramses did not refer to the capital itself. And that's true. With respect to both the name Ramses, Hofmeyr objects, rightly in my mind, as something we're going to talk about today. You know, we'll get into this. Hofmeyr objects to Redford's argument that Ra Mes Su is different than Ramses because of the spelling. And there's really two elements to Redford's argument there. One is the S letter is different in Egyptian and Hebrew. And also there's a whole other syllable that's missing, Ra-am-sees, as opposed to Ra-mes-su. There's that ah syllable that's missing. The S syllable talk isn't really that important, so I agree with Hofmeyr that that's not much of an argument. But the missing syllable Hofmeyr never addresses. And that's important to what Redford is saying. So again, Redford just approaches this from a different perspective. And you can say, well, where does this leave us? Well, as always, with not being able to prove either date by means of Exodus 1:11, that's just the way it is. You can go back and forth with all these detailed arguments, you know. But to be fair, you know, the late date isn't undone by the editorial updating issue. It just, you know, you can argue till you're blue in the face about minutiae like letters and syllables in names, and whether the S sound in Egyptian has more than one S sound, and Hebrew has two. You know, sibilance in linguistic talk. You know, Egyptian actually has several, actually has more than two. Hebrew has two. So what the fact that, you know, they're inconsistently used when a place name goes from one language to the other and from that other language back to Egyptian, you know, what do we do with that stuff? But that's the level of argumentation you get on this verse, Exodus 1:11. within the bigger debate of the date of the Exodus. I mean, it's so granular. It's so detailed. And this is why, again, we're going to move on to what we're covering today. But this is why I hope this sort of mind-numbing stuff illustrates something that you should be suspicious when you read something on the internet or something that's not peer-reviewed material, claiming to solve the date of the Exodus or claiming to, you know, locate a specific biblical site with, you know, this particular thing over here. And, oh, you know, this is so obvious. You know, all we got to do is visit there. All we got to do is look at this. All we got to do is think this thought and the problem solved. No, it isn't. These debates are centuries old for a reason, actually for many reasons. It gets very granular, very detailed in terms of linguistic evidence, archaeological evidence. Arguments hinge. They move one way or the other based on minutia. And if you're reading something that has not considered the minutia and interacted with peer-reviewed material that does interact with the minutia, feel free to dismiss it. Okay, it is just not up to snuff. If you're going to be serious about, you know, research, you must interact with the minutia. Otherwise, you're going to overlook something and make fallacious arguments. So let's just take the granular level of the detail here as kind of a learning tool about how biblical studies is done, and that we should not just, you know, all commentary about a subject is not equal. It just isn't. People with a high degree of expertise have considered all the things that need to be considered over and over and over again, and they have interacted with other people just like them. So when you get researchers and writers who don't do any of that work, aren't even really aware of that work, don't just adopt what they say. Realize that there are reasons why these debates have persisted. It's not easy. Just isn't. So today we're in Exodus 2, 1 through 10. I'm going to read the passage, and we're going to get into sort of a big item and then a smaller item in the episode today. But we want to start off by reading the actual passage. And we're going to go through the first 10 verses. And it's there's a lot to consider here. There's just, again, it's Exodus. There's just so many things going on here. And, you know, some things that might appear a bit obvious. You know, hey, I want to drill down on that. I'm curious about this thing that I can see clearly. And then there are other things that are sort of lurking in the background that you may or may not be aware of that are really crucial, again, to the way academics, the way scholars think about Exodus 2, 1 through 10. So, reading from ESV, we read this. Now, a man from the house of Levi, or Levi, went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister, the child's sister, said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And the Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Now, again, this is a very familiar story. I think the basic elements of this are, frankly, pretty obvious. So, you know, we're not terribly concerned about sort of retelling the story and doing, you know, kind of a sermon, you know, some sort of sermonic material on. What I want to drill down on are two things. Again, one of them is kind of obvious, the other's not. We're going to do the non-obvious first because it's the longest and it's probably the most challenging. And then at the end, you know, the second part, we'll do that then. The second one, the one that's sort of easier, is what about the name Moses? You know, how does that work with Egyptian? You know, does it make sense? And that's something that always comes up. You know, you read books about Exodus or the Old Testament, Israel and Egypt, and you get that sort of discussion. Depending on what kind of books, though, you're reading, if you have studied Exodus on your own, you may or may not hit the first topic we're going to consider, the big one. And that is, there's a genre, a literary issue here. Specifically, there are two aspects to this. When I say a literary or a genre issue, there are a lot of other stories, a lot of them, that feature an abandoned child or an abandoned hero who, in some instances, the circumstances are very similar to what you read in Exodus 2. And then this abandoned child, you know, grows up and does great things. Now, there are a lot of these stories. I'm going to reference yet another article by Redford. Again, Redford is an Egyptologist, so he's taken an interest in Egyptian stuff in the book of Exodus. That's why we're referring to, you know, his material more than once. But there's one specific story that has the closest parallels to Exodus 2:10. And I'm going to give you the title of that story now, and we'll get into it as we proceed here. But that is the Sargon birth legend. Now, if you're doing your research on the internet, you're going to read things like the writer of Exodus copied the Sargon birth legend to create the story of Moses in Exodus 2. Again, I think that's drastically overstated, but that's what you get on the internet. But we need to get into the subject, and I think you'll see, you know, why pretty quickly. So I'm going to be referencing, when I say Redford's article on the exposed child or the abandoned child, the article I'm referring to is, again, by Donald Redford. It's entitled "The Literary Motif of the Exposed Child, Exodus 2, 1 through 10. And this is from the scholarly journal Newman. It's N-U-M-E-N, volume 14, number 3. It was written in 1967, pages 209 to 228. Now, what Redford does in this is he marshals all of the similar stories that in some way feature a child, a baby, that is abandoned or put under threat, you know, basically disposed of in some way, and, you know, collects those and then makes some comparative comments in relationship to Exodus as part of the article. The entire article doesn't focus on the comparison. What he does is he groups the stories into sort of three categories. And his three themes, or his three, you know, thematic categories are, number one, you have stories where the child is exposed through shame at some circumstance of birth, like maybe the child's illegitimate, maybe the child has a deformity, maybe the child is you know, a quote-unquote, you know, hybrid. In other words, the offspring of a god coming down and copulating with a woman or raping a woman. You know, there are some Greek stories like that. So the child is a product of a rape. You know, that sort of thing. So that's the first kind of theme, the thematic, you know, element of his three. Now, Redford provides 14 examples, two of which have a box or container being put into water. You know, the baby or the child is put into this container and put into the water as an element. But the stories in this category, this isn't actually where Redford puts the Moses story, because the other features of the stories in this category are honestly pretty bizarre. You've got the infant being suckled by a bear or a wolf or a cow, you know, to keep it alive. And you got other really just truly bizarre sorts of elements, but you know, two of them, at least two of the 14, have this box or container in water. That was the method of disposal of the child. And I hope you're catching that I'm saying disposal, because that is going to be a point of disconnect with the Exodus story. The mother of Moses in the Exodus 2 story isn't trying to just dispose of him. There's no shame here. Again, this is, again, part of why Redford does not include the Exodus story in this first category. But again, you'll see on the internet some of these examples that are plucked out, and one of them is the Sargon birth legend. Sargon is a, you know, an illegitimate child. So that's a big disconnect with what's going on in the book of Exodus, just out of the gate. So much so that, again, Redford's not an evangelical Christian. He's got no Christian or inspiration axe to grind. he just doesn't see the similarity here with the Sargon birth legend. But that's sort of the go-to analogy on the internet and, you know, in other popular resources for the origin of the Moses story. But again, here we have a good example of Redford saying, oh, not really. You know, there's just too much that's different here. Now, the second category is that someone in power wants the child dead. And Redford provides 13 examples here, three of which, again, have this container or the water threat. Now, this one, I mean, you know, this one applies, you know, to Exodus 2 because the baby Moses is under threat. You know, his life is at stake here because of the, you know, killing off the male children that we've talked about before. So this category fits. And again, you have three examples where you've got, you know, the container and the water. But Redford opts for category three to sort of, this is his best, in his view, that the best, you know, analogy, or at least the right category for Exodus 2. And that is, there's a general massacre going on that endangers the child. And Redford gives us five examples of the abandoned child motif that include this element. And so this really speaks to him as being the closest sort of circumstance to the Moses story. And so this is where he'll actually list the Moses story in his article. Interestingly enough, he also puts the Jesus story in this one. You remember when Jesus, you know, was taken to Egypt to flee, you know, Herod. Herod, you know, wants all the boys from 2 years old and under to die. So Redford, again, interestingly enough, puts the Jesus story in the same category. Now that gives us a total of 32 stories with at least some similarity. And you've got, again, five or six, you just call it half dozen, that have this container and water thing going on, which is, again, a big part of the Exodus 2 story. But of the 32, we should also mention that fewer than half of them involve mere human children. That means more, you know, more than half of these stories concerns a child fathered illegitimately by a divine being or a rape. And the Moses story clearly does not fit that. So, you know, right away we've got, that raises a question mark over the idea. Well, did the biblical writer like know a bunch of these stories and then want to pattern his story deliberately after them? Well, a lot of them, if he was doing that, why not have like an angel coming and saying, hey, you're going to have a kid. His name's going to be Moses and this and that's going to happen. You know, kind of like the Jesus story, okay? Why don't we have some sort of divine appearance or input or something going on, you know, like with Samson. Samson isn't part of this discussion here, but, you know, the angel of the Lord shows up and announces to Samson's parents they're going to have a child. You know, it's just something like that. We don't get that in Exodus 2. So it's a significant disconnect. There's no reason to conclude Moses is anything else but a normal human baby. So over half the examples, again, have a significant disconnection with what's going on in Exodus 2. Now, Redford, again, is obviously well aware of this, and we know where he puts it. He puts it in the third category. And he knows that other scholars have tried to argue that Exodus 2, you know, is an adaptation of this or that specific story. Since he's an Egyptologist, he spends a lot of time in this article discussing the birth of Horus. And you know, again, he devotes a good bit of attention to, you know, as an Egyptologist, why the birth of Horus doesn't really provide a good literary analogy, does not, again, provide a good literary analogy with the Exodus 2 story. And he's also going to reject, you know, the Sargon story, but we'll get to that in a moment. Redford goes through the birth story of Horus, and he rejects, again, the alleged Egyptian antecedents to the Moses story as source parallels. Specifically, he notes that the parallels to the birth of Horus, there is a craft, a little boat or whatever, of papyrus made of reeds. The child is hidden in a marsh. There's a villain bent on the death of the child. He notes those elements are there, but he points out that those elements of the Horus, you know, birth story come from a very late, you know, set of texts, very late versions from the Greco-Roman period. And so Redford actually argues that the writers of the Horus, you know, myth were very likely familiar with the Moses story. And it could have, you know, been fertilized the other way around. I mean, Redford is pretty transparent about that, you know, with the chronology of the text. And so for those listening, I wanted to mention that because again, there's a lot of internet stuff, zeitgeist. You know, zeitgeist is typically trying to say, you know, Jesus is Horus or whatever. But you're going to run into this as well, you know, with the Moses story. Ah, it's just taken from the Horus story, and Moses is like a, you know, archetypal for Jesus, and so that's why Jesus, you know, gets to be a, you know, rehash of Horus. And it breaks down, and you even have Egyptologists that just say, well, if we're honest here, the material is really late, and so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, again, as it pertains to our subject here in Exodus 2. Now, where we want to camp, though, is really the Sargon birth story. So I'm going to read you a summary of the elements here from Redford's article. And specifically, this article of Redford is the one about the abandoned child motif. And so on page 214 in Redford's first category, he lists the Sargon story. And it goes like this, just a little paragraph. He says, Sargon is born in secret into a family which has apparently been at home in upland country. His birthplace, however, is a city on the Euphrates, where his mother puts him in a reed ark and casts it upon the river. Found by a drawer of water, Sargon is brought up as his son. Although no reason is given for the secrecy of the birth, it is clear that it was interdicted by someone. Sargon was probably not the object of a jealous king's search, but simply the bastard offspring of a woman whose station in life condemned her to childlessness. Then he has a footnote where he discusses that. But for our purposes here, there's this thing out there in Akkadian literature, Akkadian and Assyrian Mesopotamian literature, called the Sargon birth legend. And it has these elements. Sargon, little baby, you know, put into a reed box or ark, little boat made of reeds, cast into the river, found by somebody coming down to draw water, and then Sargon, you know, grows up to be this great king, this, you know, the Sargon the Great. And this is centuries, you know, Sargon, at least Sargon the Great, that person lived centuries before, you know, the Israelites were in Egypt, centuries before Moses. Now, the question is, though, how old are the texts? And we're going to get into that, because the person that we know from Mesopotamian history is that's one thing, but then what's written about that person is quite another. When you run into these texts, not just Mesopotamian texts, but Egyptian and biblical texts, I mean, you have to ask yourself, well, is the writing contemporaneous with the person that we're reading about? You know, we talked about Job a few minutes ago. You know, Job is set in the patriarchal era, but again, by virtue of the language used throughout the book, it's much later. We have, you know, these sorts of situations where the biblical content is written centuries after the fact of what's being described, and that's normal. Again, it's ubiquitous actually in antiquity. There's nothing unusual about that. So again, just a heads up that when we talk about Sargon the person living at a certain specific time, well before Moses, that's different than talking about the literary text or texts from which we get the Sargon birth story. Okay, they're not contemporaneous in terms of time. Now, the elements, again, are kind of obvious. And this has become sort of a big topic of discussion, you know, in popular biblical studies. And I use the internet for an example, where you get some good stuff and you get some really ridiculous stuff too. There's a dissertation on this subject that is fairly old. It was done in 1976. And it's by a guy named Brian Lewis. It's called The Legend of Sargon, A Study of the Akkadian Text and the Tale of the Hero Who Was Exposed at Birth. The dissertation was done at NYU, New York University, again, 1976. And this is the most detailed study of the Sargon birth legend. Goes through just every aspect of this. And on pages 182 to 184, Lewis writes a few things that I think are really worth pointing out, worth quoting, that sort of gets us into that. So the question before us is, okay, the Exodus 2 story is very similar to a bunch of these abandoned child stories, but, you know, a lot of them can sort of be winnowed out by, you know, one or more factors. And the one that everybody seems to zero in on is this one about Sargon, because the elements are close. You know, we have, you know, text to this effect. Redford, again, is weeding out the Horus story because the textual material is so late. It's basically so late, it's irrelevant. So what we're really left with as sort of the primary point of attention is this Sargon story. So that's why we're going to spend some time on it. So we're going to go through some thoughts that Lewis and his dissertation shared, and then just, you know, think ourselves about, well, what do we do with this? So Lewis writes, in considering the problem of determining the date of composition, you know, when this the Sargon legend was written, you know, when we're considering that problem, one is faced with a long period during which the genre to which the text belongs was alive, and little, if any, obvious internal criteria with which to fix a date. Okay. So right away, Lewis is admitting, again, this is the most detailed study of the Sargon legend in the Akkadian, in the original texts that we have. He's like, basically, we can't fix a date. He continues and says, it may in fact be impossible to establish with any certainty the origins of the Sargon legend based on the available evidence. The text lacks any obvious grammatical, lexicographical, or philological feature which would allow a precise dating. Unfortunately, aside from its possible mention in two inventories of texts from Kujunjik, which is, again, a location in Mesopotamia, there are no known references to the Sargon legend in all of cuneiform literature. The copies whose fragments we possess are relatively late. Three fragments belonging to the Kujunjik collection are written in Neo-Assyrian script, and a fourth fragment written in Neo-Babylonian is probably even later. Now, let me stop there. Neo-Assyrian is going to be 900, 800, 700 BC. Okay, it is not, you know, if Sargon goes back to the 24th, 23rd centuries BC, you're dealing with well over 1,000, 1,500 years later is what the text dates to. So again, the person Sargon the Great, again, you can fix a date based on cuneiform literature, you know, Sumerian, Mesopotamian literature, you know, old Babylonian stuff, old Akkadian stuff. We know when this guy lived. But this legend that's written about him is 1,500 years at least later in terms of the text we have. And if you're looking at Assyrian dates, this is actually going to be after even critical scholar datings for the E material. Okay, Exodus is considered E, J-E-D-P, you know, back to the whole theory of the Pentateuch. So if you believe in Mosaic authorship, I mean, there's no question. It's either 1,400 BC or 1,200 BC. Again, centuries earlier than the Sargon birth legend. If you, again, go with JEDP, it's still a century or two earlier than the Sargon stuff, than the Assyrian period. So right away, we have a chronological problem for trying to say that the writer of Exodus 2 used the Sargon birth legend. If you're going with the text we actually have, that is an impossible argument to be that specific. Okay, it's an argument that just can't be made on the basis of data, which means if you're going to make that argument, you're making it up. You're just going with it without data. That's just the way it is. Now back to Lewis. He says, the question is, are these late copies of a text which had originated at a much earlier period? So he says, what we have is late. But the question is, are they copies of a much older text that we no longer have? Again, that's an open question. So are these late copies of a text which had originated at a much earlier period, or perhaps the remnants of a late composition which may have only been loosely based on earlier sources of some kind? Now we have seen that the use of the royal epithet Sharu-Danu, strong king, in line 1, is an anachronism in a text attributed to Sargon of Agade, or Agade, if you want to anglicize it here, A-G-A-D-E. For the first occurrence is to be found in the 8th regnal year of Amar-Sin, 2039 BC of the 3rd dynasty of Ur, and thus follows by 240 years the end of Sargon's rule. Therefore, the ascription of the title to Sargon in this work proves that the legend was written after 2039 and establishes, you know, at least, you know, that much, the presence of copies in the library of Assurbanipal, whose dates are 668 to 627 BC. Provides kind of the latest point. So you have kind of an earliest point, terminus postquem, and then you have the latest point, terminus antequem of the mid-7th century. But all the tablets we actually have are in that Assyrian period, you know, the 800s, 700s, 600s BC. And what that last comment was about is even you know, some titles, you know, some in this case, this one phrase. Yeah, the phrase, you know, shows up in these earlier texts, but Lewis is saying that Assyriologists think that it's a deliberate anachronism, that some later writer just used it, again, to give it the appearance of age. Just like we were talking about, you know, earlier with, you know, Ramses. Writers do this in the ancient world. They pluck out phrases and titles and descriptive elements from texts that they know of, because they're scribes that are much older, and they'll stick them in later texts, the ones they're actually writing. Could be at, you know, 1500, 2000 years later, and they'll use these older lines, you know, older words and things like that, just to give it the flavor of antiquity. But in this case, there's only one of them. Again, you know, there are some other things that Lewis goes through, and the Assyriological community, those who are experts in cuneiform literature, recognize all of these as being anachronistic. They don't help. they don't move the tablet back, because if it's discovered, you know, in a particular library or a particular pile of cuneiform tablets that clearly date to the Assyrian period, and the script itself, the cuneiform script itself, changes over time. Even though cuneiform looks like chicken scratch, the chicken scratch of one era looks different than the chicken scratch of another. Again, and people who are into cuneiform understand that. They can see it. They create, or they have typologies, you know, for all of this kind of stuff. The texts are late, is the point. And the question of, are they copies of something that was earlier? Well, you know, we don't know. You can make that argument. So what Lewis does in his dissertation from this point on, is from about page 184 on, is he like imagines a scenario for an early origin of the story. Again, texts we don't have, but he imagines how this might have, you know, worked, how you could make the argument. And then he is fair in his dissertation, and he imagines how you would understand how things would have worked in a late period. Now, there are two points I think that are worth, you know, pointing out as well, you know, before we leave Lewis's dissertation here. He says on page 187 that in the Sargon legend text, as far as it is preserved, there is nothing, again, of a lexical, grammatical, or orthographical, the way, you know, way the characters are written. Nothing of a lexical, grammatical, or orthographical nature that need to be early. Okay? There just aren't. There's nothing in there that makes the argument that the story is early. So you are actually on very defensible ground to say that the Sargon birth legend is late, and for the sake of our discussion, later than the Moses story. You can make a really good argument for that. And again, Lewis lays out how to do it in his dissertation. On page 188, he says that there are three idiomatic expressions which occur in the legend of Sargon, this is important, that are attested only at the end of the second millennium, which would be like 1000 BC, or in the Neo-Assyrian period, again, which is this late period where the tablets that we have actually come from. He says this provides the strongest evidence available that the Sargon legend was composed in its present form at a much later date than previously thought. Again, he's not writing this. I hate to be a little silly here, but again, because of the kind of stuff you run into on the internet, I'm going to say it this way. This guy's not writing a dissertation at a Christian school or a seminary just to reflexively defend the Bible on some point that he doesn't like. This is NYU. It's a dissertation. He's an Assyriologist. Okay, let that sink in. He's being honest. He's doing what good scholars should do, regardless of what his own personal predilections are. I mean, this is the data. These are the data, I should say. And this is the conclusion that is very defensible, very late for the story. But you won't hear any of that on the internet. What you're going to be shown on the internet is you're going to be shown the Sargon birth story, and then you're going to be shown the Moses story, and somebody's going to say, see, the Bible stole more material from Mesopotamia. Really? Again, if you run into somebody claiming that, maybe the Ancient Origins website, they love to do stuff like this. You have just found a person, A, with an axe to grind, and B, who isn't a scholar. Okay, it's just that simple. This is why I say primary texts are what you should focus on. The data that actually exist. And peer-reviewed scholarship where people, they specialize in this stuff. They go through the material. And in the overwhelming number of cases, regardless of if they're a Christian or a Jew or not a Christian or an atheist, whatever, especially in dissertations, they really make an effort, you know, far and away. You know, it's not everybody, but far and away, they make an effort to be honest. And we have a good example here in Lewis's dissertation. Now, there's something else the internet won't tell you, and that is the problems of dissimilarities between the two stories, the Sargon legend and the Moses story in Exodus 2. I'll offer one more little bit from Lewis's dissertation here. He writes on page 384, so this is toward the end. For a long time, scholars had accepted the premise that the birth legends of Sargon and Moses were unusually similar in form and content. However, in recent years, and this is the 60s and 70s, work by M. Kogan, M. Greenberg, and others has challenged this assumption by stressing the different motivations for the abandonment. By asserting a closer parallel between the Moses story and an Egyptian myth concerning Horus. Of course, Redford, you know, essentially debunks that with the late material. But I quote that to say that other scholars besides Lewis, besides Redford, again, have not thought of the Sargon birth story as a really good parallel. Now, Redford doesn't like either. He doesn't like the Horus story. He doesn't like the Sargon story. But some other scholars have looked at the Sargon story and go, there's just too much different about it for it to have been a model. There's just too much different. And again, the textual situation is that it's very late anyway. So it isn't just one guy. It isn't just Redford. I mean, there are other people who have noticed this, and they've tried out the Egyptian story. But like I said, Redford doesn't like that either because the material is just so late. How in the world could this work? So let's go into some of the differences here. Here's the short list. There are five. We'll just give you a short list of five, and Lewis summarizes these. The Hebrew story, Exodus 2, in relation specifically to the Sargon story, has some significant disconnections. One, the concept of genocide as the motivating factor underlying the need to abandon the child. Okay, that is not in the Sargon story. Certainly in the Exodus story, Moses is exposed to save his life from a threat to all Hebrew male infants. That's just not part of the Sargon story. Number two, the hero, the child, is hidden for 3 months. Okay, that's the Exodus story, until it's no longer possible to conceal him. You don't get that in the Sargon story. The role of the sister in the Exodus story, who watches over the hero, the child, from a distance as the representative of the mother, you don't get that. Four, the use of Pharaoh's daughter to rescue and adopt the infant. Again, you don't have a royal daughter. I mean, and fifth, the hiring of the natural mother to nurse the child. Again, here are five core elements to the Exodus 2 story that do not appear in the Sargon story. And all you have is the means to float the baby. Well, look, if you lived in the Delta, the Egyptian Delta, and we know that they lived there because you have, the whole Pithom and Ramses thing, Avaris, the land of Goshen, all that stuff. Back in Genesis, we know where the Hebrews were at, and it's the Delta region. So there's lots of water there, and there's lots of marshes there. If you were going to hide the child from Pharaoh's men, where would you put him? It's at least a possibility you would think, I can't stash the kid at home because it's not like we have IKEA furniture here where we can put him somewhere and no one will ever find him. Okay? You're limited in your options. If you're going to put him outside, hide him in the marsh. And you can't just throw the kid in. You got to build something. You got to create something that'll float. Again, this is just sort of a normal thing. If you consider this a possibility, you would just do these things. And that's the only real similarity between the Exodus story and the Sargon story. All this other stuff is different and significantly different because these aren't just sort of throwaway elements in the story. These elements are crucial to the story because the story gives us this providential irony. That's a big theme in the Exodus 2 story about how the little baby's sister goes out, to watch and sees, little baby Moses taken out of the water and she's right on the spot. I mean, it's calculated, it's planned, it's ironic, and speaks to the Egyptian woman. Hey, should we go get a nurse to nurse the child? Sure, great idea. And so the little girl, her sister, runs and goes and gets his mom. Again, these details are important to, again, telling and showing us how God providentially inverted and really subverted what's going on in Egypt. He uses Pharaoh's household from which, you know, the administration from which the command to kill the male children came to save the deliverer. And these are very obvious things. They're crucial to the story. They are not throwaway elements, and none of them are in their Sargon story. Now, I'm going to go to Carpenter, his commentary on Exodus. He has a few things to say about this as well. And then we'll transition into our second question, you know, that will, you know, be the conclusion of our episode here. But Carpenter writes about, the comparison here. He says, this is not the case of the exposure or rejection of an unwanted infant. And again, that just runs through the stories, these other, you know, abandoned child stories frequently. This is the purposeful and tender dedication of an infant to the sovereignty of God. The writer-editor may have employed the genre form of the Sargon legend, you know, just sort of the, you know, structurally, the, you know, some of the elements here, but he has emptied it of its mythological overtones and filled it with Israelite history and theology. He has effectively changed its content and structure to fit his purposes, creating a historical narrative, even antithetical to the Sargon legend, to fit his purposes. It is evident that major essential differences exist between these two ancient narratives. Also, Hofmeyr is probably correct to challenge this supposed borrowing from Mesopotamian literature, since the whole section, Exodus 2, verses 1 through 10, is permeated with specifically Egyptian elements. Now, he quotes Hofmeyr here, or at least he footnotes Hofmeyr, pages 138 to 140. Hofmeyr lists six specific expressions, textual expressions, that are Egyptian and not Mesopotamian in origin. If you're just borrowing a Mesopotamian story, why would you do that? If you're writing either in an Egyptian context or the events that you're writing about took place in an Egyptian context, then this makes sense, again, to have these Egyptian elements in it. You know, if you're just doing something, you know, much later, hey, I need a good story, and then I'm gonna sort of steal it and adopt it, you wouldn't think, well, let's just throw, you know, Egyptian words in there or Egyptian phrases or idioms or something. You wouldn't do that. You know, you wouldn't do that. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So Hofmeyr again says we have to look at the Egyptian elements in here to really, you know, make sense of it, because the Sargon story by itself would have been perfectly serviceable if that's what's happening. Now, all of this suggests that the biblical writer, again, if we take all this as a whole, was not dependent on the Horus myth, certainly. Again, Redford points out that material is so late. And it also suggests he was not dependent on the Sargon story either. The key word there is dependent. In both cases, the Moses story may predate the presumed source, either the Sargon source and certainly, you know, the Horus stuff. It's conceivable that the Moses story predates both of those. And if you're looking at it that way, then you have to approach the whole subject a little bit differently. Now, we could ask, you know, well, what if the biblical writer or a later editor knew about the Sargon story? Let's just play what if here. I would say that doesn't rule out the coherence of Exodus 2 being an actual event. In fact, it's a perfect way. It's really a good way to frame the birth of the one who delivered Yahweh's people out of chaos. Because ultimately, Moses is going to lead the Israelites out of Egypt and through the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea in English Bibles. Water, again, the chaos symbol. Linking it conceptually in some way to Mesopotamian material is actually a really good idea, especially if it's associated with Babylon. Now, Van der Merop, who's an author of A History of the Ancient Near East, on page 63 says, the last centuries of the third millennium were characterized by successive periods of centralization of power under two city dynasties, one from Akkad in northern Babylonia in the 24th and 23rd centuries BC, and the other from Ur in the far south of the 21st century, unquote. Now, Akkad is where Sargon the Great ruled. That's where he's from, and that's where he ruled. And so he is associated with Babylon by virtue of the location of this city. It's in North Babylonia. There would have been a telling irony. Think about it this way. There would have been a telling irony and a theological polemic if, and we're just playing what if here, if the writer used the legend of Sargon of Akkad's birth story to tell the story of the rise of Yahweh's deliverer, really his savior figure, for rescuing his people from chaos. Those people, of course, had originated from Abraham, himself from Ur. And this works whether Ur is in southern Babylon, southern Babylonia, or northwest Mesopotamia. It's still Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is the referent point, again, for a lot of the chaos stuff we see in Genesis 1 through 11. The irony and messaging is the same. Yahweh is greater than his chaos rivals. In other words, the similarity of the birth stories would draw attention to a literate Israelite or Jew to Yahweh's defeat of chaos. In other words, if you link the birth of the deliverer in Exodus 2, if you link that to something Mesopotamian, even though you know, there's all these Egyptian elements, if you link it in some way, if people are reading that, and yeah, the story is set in Egypt, but you know, this kind of sounds like that Mesopotamian dude. If that's what's happening in somebody's head, then the writer gets to compare and contrast what Yahweh is doing to save his people out of chaos. And it takes your mind back to when the chaos began and where it began, where it's rooted. Babylon, Mesopotamia. Genesis 1 through 11, I've said it many times in the podcast, is just cluttered with Mesopotamian material for a reason. This is where it's the anti-Eden. There's so much content in Genesis 1 through 11 that responds to, that inverts, that subverts Mesopotamian stuff, okay, and tells the story, you know, of just Deuteronomy 32 worldview, Babel, just that one, just Genesis 11, that's the big one. But you got Genesis 6 with the Abkalu, you got stuff in Genesis 1 through 3 that, you know, takes us back to Mesopotamia. Genesis 1 through 11 is designed to pit God's desire for Eden against the anti-Eden, the forces of chaos, all of the forces that disrupt what God wants on earth. And the metaphor for doing that is consistently Babylon, Babylonia, you know, this part of the world. And Sargon the Great comes from that part of the world. That's where he lived. That's where he ruled. And so if you intentionally do enough of a comparative work in the way you tell the story of Moses' birth to make people think of that place instead of just Egypt, you have accomplished something significant. You have made the reader see that Yahweh is at work subverting and defeating the forces of chaos that are very, very ancient, more ancient than Egypt. So again, this is just a little thought experiment. It's just a what if. Again, there's no way literarily to prove this, you know, any sort of dependence or cross-fertilization, because the material as we have it is late. But just what if? I mean, to me, it's really, it's just fascinating that a writer could be so clever. And by the way, none of that rules out the historicity of the event. It's just literary strategy for theologizing the event. The event, of course, being Moses' birth. Theologizing an event and the event are not, you know, the historicity of the event are not mutually exclusive. They're not. Remember the story of how I got my job at Logos? All those events happened. Now, again, the way I tell the story is I'm making God a character. I'm making God a behind-the-scenes actor in the events that unfold. And I'm not telling you that under inspiration, okay? I have no divine guidance to tell you that. That was just my perception. But my perception, my theologizing of what happened, my making it a mythic narrative, doesn't mean that the events didn't happen. They did. It's just the retelling of the story to make a theological point, to make my listeners think theologically important thoughts. And this is precisely what I'm suggesting, that if the writer of Exodus, or you know, an editor or whatever, had knowledge of the Sargon story, it would be really clever to use some of that in how the story is told, even in a deeply Egyptian context, because your literate reader, their mind is going to go back to where chaos began, to why we have the people of God, God selecting Abram out of the region we know as Babylonia, whether it was the north or the south, doesn't matter. God selects a person out after he has divorced the nations, severed the relationship between him and them. He plucks this guy out of his polytheistic context. We learn he was raised in a polytheistic context in Babylonia. Okay, from Genesis 11, he plucks this guy out. He makes a covenant with him and his wife to raise up a new family, a new human family. He's not giving up on the original Edenic plan. He's going to use this guy and his offspring through this woman who can't have children. So she's perfect. Again, it's a supernatural event. He's going to use her and him to create a human family. And through them, he makes a covenant that will draw all of these other nations back home. In other words, it will cure chaos. Again, this is really, really clever. But we're just playing what if here. But it does not rule out the historicity. It's a literary strategy. And there are other examples of this. You know, it's not a coincidence that Egypt in other parts of the Old Testament is actually identified with Babylon in other ways. Egypt is actually identified with Babylon in the Old Testament as a chaos agent. For example, Pharaoh is cast as Leviathan in Ezekiel 29, verse 3, and Ezekiel 32, 2. It's Ezekiel. He's writing from a Babylonian context. He's talking about Pharaoh of Egypt, but he's using Leviathan again, the wonderful, you know, wonderfully elastic, you know, chaos symbol. The Babylonian context, again, is very evident. It seems reasonable that given the non-bizarre circumstances of the Moses story and the proximity of the Hebrews living in the Delta to marshy areas, that we have a story, a real story of a real event, a desperate mother who risked the life of her child on a gamble that he'd be discovered by someone, a woman of importance. I call it a gamble, but it's a faith-based gamble. She's trusting God. There's nothing uncomely about his birth. He's not undesirable. He's not like some divine hybrid. It just seems a reasonable act of desperation by a woman. It's reasonable, at least in its details. She doesn't just set the kid afloat anywhere, toss him in. She has to build a little craft. What would you do? You do the same thing. Egyptians have Hebrew servants, so it's not unusual that the little slave girl would show up, would be allowed, you know, to show up and have a conversation. We talked about that, you know, when we talked about the Israelite bondage. Again, all the elements are there. There's no evidence as well that the infant Moses was circumcised. And so the child would have blended into an Egyptian context. We don't read Moses ever got circumcised. We're going to hit some of that where we discuss that. But here, no. It seems reasonable that a really good strategy for linking Babylon and Egypt as chaos agents who will be defeated by Yahweh, raising up a human deliverer, it'd be really reasonable to play off the Sargon story and blend in the Egyptian material of the actual historical context. You kill two birds with one stone. And again, you're not fabricating events, you're theologizing. It's extraordinarily clever, is really how I look at this. It's really, really clever. Now, the last item, again, we'll transition here. There's just one thing I want to say real briefly about Moses' name. And I'll put Lewis's dissertation in the protected folder, you know, in case people are interested in this. And I'll put this article as well in the protected folder. Even though this one's going to be dense, you'd more or less have to have some Hebrew or Semitic or some language study to really kind of get this. But in regard to Moses' name, there's an article that's a really good one by J. Gwyn. That's G-W-Y-N Griffiths. It's titled The Egyptian Derivation of the Name Moses. It's Journal of Near Eastern Studies, Volume 12, Number 4, October 1953. It's about 8 pages long, but it's a very thorough treatment of how scholars have tried to link Moshe in Hebrew, that's Mem, Shin, and then He, with something in Egyptian and do it coherently, because there are things that don't align in the possibilities. Moses, again, you know, we get this little comment at the end. You know, she named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Well, again, it requires a little bit of thought. And in this article, Griffiths goes through all the options. And essentially, I'm just cutting to the chase here because it's full of Egyptian and transliteration. It's full of Hebrew and all this other stuff. She argues really well. And she's just drawing on other research and then answering a few questions that are kind of outliers, that what we have here is Moses is Mes, that's M-S in Egyptian. And it's not a verb to draw out. She believes, and again, she has really good reason for arguing this, and she has really good examples, that that term just means child. So when we go back to Exodus 2, verse 10, what we see happening is here is the woman, you know, the Pharaoh's daughter, takes the child out of water, and she says, I'll just read it. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. She became his son. And she named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. So the Egyptian is saying, I'm going to call him Mes, which means child in Egypt. I'm going to call the child, child. And Mes in Egyptian was actually used as a proper name. Again, Griffith's article gives really good examples of this. It's not unusual. It's not odd. It's not unknown. It was also a proper name that would get appended to a deity name like Ra-Mes, what we would think of as Ramses. Okay, Ra-Mes would be, like son of Ra or something like that, or Ra is born. Griffiths points out these names were usually commemorating the birthday of a deity, that kind of thing. But in this case, if there was an original Egyptian theophoric element, a deity name that Pharaoh's daughter stuck onto this, the biblical writer takes it off and we're just left with, Moshe. Mes in Egyptian just means child. So she names the child, child. She calls him child, Moses, we'll just say, because I drew him out of the water. Now, a lot of your commentaries will try to link an Egyptian term for drawing out with the name Moses. I think that's a mistake. I think the point is that Pharaoh's daughter calls him child. And when she says, because I drew him from the water, it means because I saved him and kept him. In other words, the drawing out of the child is not an etymological clue to the Egyptian term behind the name Moses. It refers to the event. I'm going to call this child Moses because I saved him. He's mine. Again, it's a much neater solution. Again, there are places you can go to read about the other ones. Griffith's article, Hoffmeyer's book, pages 140 to 142 goes through this. I think Hoffmeyer tries to be diplomatic to Kenneth Kitchen, and he had a real affection for Kitchen, as did a lot of other people. And having met him once, I can see why. But Kitchen wants to have the woman who says, I drew him up out of the water, to be Moses' real mom, but Moses' real mom didn't draw him out of the water. It was Pharaoh's daughter. So I think we can lay that option aside, even though, again, Hoffmeyer tries to be nice about that in what he writes, but he's well aware of Griffith's article, interacts with it, and I think that's the simplest, neatest solution. Mes, M-S, is a very normal Egyptian term. If you're really into philology and Semitic linguistic stuff, get Griffith's article for what happened to the H in Moshe and how the S in Mes and the Sh in Moshe align. There's linguistic coherence to that. If you want to read that stuff, you can. But I wanted to just append a little bit on this because, people are curious, does this work in Egyptian language? It does. It does. And it makes sense in context. So that was a lot to digest. Again, most of our episode this time, focused on the abandoned child motif, but it's really important because people are going to use the story here. Like I said, what you're going to get on the internet is they're going to, say, oh, let's go read Exodus 2. Got that down? You got it in your head now? Well, look at the Sargon birth story. And then they're going to say the writer, of Exodus 2, biblical writers stealing material. It's so utterly simplistic and really fundamentally uninformed that you should know about it. And so I wanted to make that the centerpiece of this episode.
All right, Mike, another jam-packed episode, and we're only in halfway through chapter 2, so.
It's just more nuts and bolts, nuts and bolts. You run into stuff everywhere.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to take a break from Exodus next week, and we're going to be interviewing the guys from the Bible Project, Tim Mackey and John Collins.
Yep. Right?
So that'll be a nice break from Exodus, and hear from those
guys. It'll be fun, too.
All right, Mike, we'll be looking forward to that. And then the week after that, we're going to finish up chapter 2.
Yep.
And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.